Are you listening?
It's Anything and Everything with Mel.
Damn.
Hey everyone, this is Anything and Everything with Matt, one of our first video podcasts we'll be doing. I'm here today with my psych professor, Mr. Bradley Mitchell. How's it going?
It's going well.
So, I guess we'll start with, telling us a little about yourself.
As you mentioned, I'm a psychology professor for Ivy Tech in Valparaiso, Indiana. I have quite a few different specializations, kind of eclectic in what I enjoy right now. My interests lie in behaviorism and also consciousness, how the interplay of what we do in daily life is manifested internally within us.
Very interesting. And how long have you been studying that?
I've been studying psych since I can remember, but just bouncing around into different specializations is kind of a perk of being in the academic world, because you can basically whatever it is you get interested in, you can kind of use the teaching environment to kind of bounce ideas off of people. So I've been really interested in consciousness for the last couple of years, because it's just been a topic that doesn't get addressed a lot. It's one of the softer sciences, because there's no tool out there that can really effectively measure consciousness, and so it's a little bit more on the realm of philosophy. But it's still something that we need to have a good understanding of.
So, do you believe that the consciousness is more of a thing that's just in the brain, like? You think it's just created from the brain, or do you think it is something that is beyond, life?
The struggle to even ask the question indicates that it's something that we don't even have a good foothold on where to start. For the longest time, we've been dealing with the brain and the mind as this dualistic thing. 2,000 years, we've been saying that dualism is what's going on. We have a brain and we have a mind. And so one is the meat machine, one is the carbon-based entity, and the other one is kind of the ineffable, can't touch it thing. And dualism has always said that these two things they're two separate things, but they are inextricably linked. When you unlink them, you no longer have a human being. I kind of struggle with the mind being or consciousness being simply a product of the brain, because we have so many different instances where there's incomplete brains or brains that have fundamentally changed, and yet the mind remains. And then tiny little changes to the brain indicate that a new mind or a new person or a new consciousness comes into being. And so we don't have a really great understanding of that. Coupled with the fact that, not to go too Freudian, because I know that kind of turns people off, but there's consciousness, there's subconsciousness, there's unconsciousness, and we treat the subconscious and the unconscious as if it isn't us. I always hear people say, I had a dream about something, and I had, this event happen, but I can't control my dream. Well, if you can't control your dream, then who the heck can? It's you. And so if you are unconsciously thinking of something, who is that? Who is making that thought process? And so it's fun, because the more you dig, the deeper the hole is. And I've yet to figure out a way to dig upwards. So it's just a very interesting topic to get lost in.
Yeah, I can see that. It's very, controversial, because some people believe that, that we are sentient and we are in control of our own choices. And then there are some people who believe that we don't have free will, and that everything is kind of, based off of something, some other chemical reaction in our brain making us do what we do. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of scary when you think about it,
Yeah.
It really.
And that's a new subfield out there called behavioral economics. And behavioral and neuroeconomics. And one of the tenets of neuroeconomics is that we basically, all decisions are made by the neurology of the brain and the biochemistry of the brain, and the and our consciousness is basically spending all its time justifying why we did that, because we are a single entity. So there is, there's a theory out there that says we're basically just, we are lacking of free will, but we're consciously trying to justify why we did something because we're the ones who are doing it. And they've, in that, they've actually had some pretty interesting research where they've actually shown that these decisions are being made before the person even knows that they're making the decision. And so the only thing the consciousness can do is be justifying why they did it. And it gets into cognitive dissonance of, I did it, therefore I must have had a reason for it. And that's what the mind is doing. And that gets scary for some people because, you know, it gets into that, well, then who is the controller? You know, who, if I can't control the my brain, if I can't control my neurochemistry, we have this innate human belief that somebody has to be in control. So who is it? And I'll leave that open because there's so many different really fun answers that you can talk about.
Mm-hmm. Like if I'm like, why did I drink that? Was it because I'm thirsty or I chose to? Like, was there a underlining reason why I did it? Like, did I choose it because I was thirsty, or did I choose it because I wanted to, you know? Like, it really makes you think, you know, who was the one who made me pick up that drink?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have tons of different, you know, models and theories, even within the realm of psychology, and psychology doesn't house everything in the world. You know, one person would say, well, that's drive reduction theory. You picked up that because you had a drive of thirst and therefore you took the drink to get rid of that drive so you can get back to homeostasis. Other people would say that it was something behavioral, that you just do this when you feel like you need to, or you feel like you're being reinforced for it. The biological person would say you need sustenance and therefore your body's just driving you to do that. And then there's other people who just, you know, sociocultural, that you took a drink because of something that was going on within the culture of this conversation. None of them are correct. They all have a component. The whole matrix theory of it all is that it's possible that you were just programmed to do that whoever did that, whoever came up with that idea.
So if all human behavior is on some level predictable, can you create like a machine or a computer that can almost simulate all of can it simulate all of the choices that you would make, and I almost predict, can it be a predicting type of system that it can? If people can predict human behavior, then could a machine do it on a rapid level? And should we be worried about that?
Yeah, a machine can actually do it on a much more effective level than a human can, because a human's always going to be taking into account the drive of the person and the idiosyncrasies of the person. A simple, you know, not even an artificial intelligence, but just a simple algorithm does a really good job of predicting what we're going to do and why we're going, not necessarily why, but it's going to know fundamentally why we are doing things, and it's going to create a possible atmosphere to make that choice be less of a choice. This is where a lot of our best psychological minds get poached into marketing, because they're trying to figure out how to move people towards a predetermined goal. And whether that just be staging in a supermarket or a Super Bowl commercial for a Kia Optima, it's all about trying to get people to not make a decision on their own, but make them kind of that inception idea of making somebody believe that they came up with an idea on their own, when actually everything was put into place for that person to do what was meant to be done by somebody who's created it.
It seems very, if you have the power of manipulation and the power to, you know, to almost predict what people are going to do, you know, based on your action. I feel like that is a great responsibility that you have, and, you know, it could be used. There's so many people who are using that, like, and taking advantage of people. There are so many, I mean, I feel like that is such a dangerous thing. You could either do what you do and help people, you know, and become a therapist with it and learn how to manipulate people to empower themselves, to learn how to empower themselves, or you can manipulate people to, you know, do your bidding or to for personal wealth and gain. I mean, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And there is a bit of a misconception, you know, with the ability of people to be manipulated, but what it comes down to is we don't need to, as humans, we actually, against what we believe about ourselves, we like to be given less choices. We actually prefer to be kind of driven in the direction of where our best options are. We believe we have this this paradox of choice where we think we want to be able to choose between 50 different cereals in the morning, but in all actuality, we would rather just be presented with two that we like, so that we're not constantly trying to make a decision off of many different things. And the whole notion of, you know, that people can manipulate people. Most people, if you take the word manipulation out, most people like to be told what their best option is. It just makes things simple for them. But if you start to tell people that they don't have their own choices, then things get a little bit more complicated and people don't like that. But for the most part, most people like being told what the best option is. It's helpful for them.
Yeah. It seems kind of like instinctual, like it's in our human nature, like tribalism, you know, to follow a leader, someone with confidence and manipulation, you know,
with the traits that we would like to see within ourselves, we tend to follow those things. And so, you know, manipulation, if you're looking at somebody who's confident and doing what you would like to do, you don't see it as manipulation. This is why, you know, kind of to jump onto a tangent, this is why when you ask people why they got into a cult, they almost always don't feel like they were in a cult. They felt like they were in a good program or a good group, because the charismatic leader that they were following had traits that they wanted for themselves. It's only the outsiders who don't see those traits that see it as a cult mentality.
Yeah. Like the story of David Koresh, that TV show that they came out with called Waco.
Yeah.
Very, very good watch. I recommend it to people who are listening. That is a great example of just how someone, like, you know, very charismatic and charming and manipulative can, what he can do to people, you know, what he can bring people to do. Mm-hmm. And I think people like that, though, who give that energy off, like they are, you know, idolized, like someone you'd like want to be. That's so attractive that I feel like it explains maybe a lot of, not saying that this is what religions, you know, people from like these people from religions are based around, but I think that like people like Jesus and people who stand out, I feel like are people who had that vibe or that energy about them that everyone wanted to be like. That any, like back when there was a world of savages and everyone was, you know, kind of, you know, fending for themselves, I feel like people like that really stood out from the crowd, you know, and attracted millions of people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's hard to compare, you know, somebody like Jesus or Buddha to David Koresh or Jim Jones. But I really think that David Koresh and Jim Jones and people like that, and even people like Charles Manson, they started out with, I don't think that most of those people started out, you know, thinking that the end of this is going to be some horrific event. They started out with good intentions, but, you know, ultimate power is something that becomes very enticing. And when somebody gets that ultimate power, things start to go terribly wrong. the beauty of kind of our religious icons is that possibly they didn't live long enough, or maybe, you know, some would say that they just lived the perfect life. Others might say, well, maybe they didn't live long enough to flame out like some of these other individuals have. To each his own.
Yeah. So what do you think? What do you think is going on with this mental health issue that's going on in the public right now with the gun or a person problem in specific, you know?
Yeah, there's a big difference between the talking heads of CNN, Fox News, Choose Your Poison, and the real world. You know, the way, if we're looking for a talking point and we're looking for a simple soundbite, then it's a gun control problem and it's a mental illness problem. But if we're really going to sit down and talk about what's going on, it is so much more complex than that. Simply put, the gun control issue, which I'm not an expert on by any stretch, but the situation down in Florida, the young man purchased these guns legally. The only thing that people are now kind of pointing to is saying, well, he did have a history of mental illness, but he didn't have a history of mental illness that would preclude him in any state that I know from purchasing a gun. And then when we get to that tipping point, then we're going to have to assign somebody the authority to determine what is the tipping point for mental illness that we don't allow somebody to purchase a gun. And I've heard a lot of people say that mental health professionals would be the people to do that, but we're not trained for that. We are trained in symptom reduction of particular psychiatric and psychic issues, and none of those issues involve going on a killing spree with a gun. Yeah,
come back on you too, if that's the case, if they're relying on you?
If they're relying on, and that would take a whole new world, a whole new paradigm of what it means to be a psychiatrist, what it means to be a psychologist, what it means to be whoever this is, because again, there's no profession out there that is, I don't even know what you'd call it, a projective interpreter of people's potential behavior. I mean, the only thing I can think of is if we get three people and put them in the water like Minority Report and they figure out who's going to be the future people. And that's not, if they offer a program like that somewhere in, you know, graduate school, it's probably a fraud. I don't think there's an actual science to that. So I don't know. We know that behavior begets behavior, but we can't point to the young man who did this horrific event. He had never gone and shot up another school before. He's never going to go and shoot up another school again. But he did some actions that people are looking at and saying, yeah, wow, he posted that he's going to be a school shooter on YouTube. Well, I would assume that if you did a search, I don't think I'd be exaggerating to say thousands of people have said something to that effect in the anonymity of Twitter and Facebook and YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be that this one fit, this one worked. And, you know, everybody's a genius in hindsight. You know, I can win the lottery every week if you allow me to buy the ticket after the drawing. And so to say that we should have taken this guy seriously, I don't know that everybody wants that to happen for themselves.
There'd be a lot of people being arrested for, you know, just saying stuff when they were angry or whatever.
Right.
Like, yeah. So, I mean, where do you draw the line? You know, because I've heard people argue that teachers should be, you know, learn how to defend students. And then that just means that, you know, not only your job would be to teach, but you're also signing up to defend students with your life and to take a student's life if need be. I mean, that's a whole nother job category and requirements right there alone. I mean, you can't ask that there's no way Mrs. Rosenwinkel and my third grade teacher is going to hold a gun. I mean,
right.
And shoot somebody. There's that. it's just a lot to ask from people. And I feel like if that was the case, teachers would be like cops or ex-veterans. And I mean, it would only require people who can handle that those types of situations or who want to, you know?
And unfortunately, my mind immediately goes to some horrific things that could happen. And, you know, I completely agree. If you're asking a teacher to become a security guard, you know, I have a hard enough time as a psychology professor. I don't want to teach sociology, and we're kind of kissing cousins of academia, and I don't feel competent to teach social 111. So to ask a teacher to not only teach a class, but also be the determining person to see, you know, who is a threat is pretty dramatic. And I can only imagine, again, I think about some of the worst case scenarios, but, you know, I wonder if we have situations of suicide by cop where people who are, you know, they want to go out in a way of a kind of a blaze of glory, or they have some kind of political reason, or they have a financial reason they want to do this. I can imagine a kid understanding that a teacher is assigned to protect the rest of the students. If a kid showed up with a gun and the teacher is told to protect the other kids, they may have to make that ultimate choice. And I can't fathom that. I can't fathom 1 minute teaching prepositional phrases and the next making a decision about what's going on in your classroom, where you have to decide what you're going to do as kind of a pseudo police officer. It seems mind numbing to me.
And imagine just how many cases of teachers who wrongfully shot kids because they thought they had a gun in their backpack, or people who, you know, the teachers are defending kids shooting at the shooter and accidentally shoot a couple kids walking in front of them. I mean, there's so many liabilities. It sounds, honestly, when you think about it, it's absurd to even ask of that of someone.
Yeah.
So is it, you were saying before about how people with mental health like that, unless you have like a predictable machine, you can't really, there's no way of determining that they're going to go out and do that. So wouldn't the best bet and the best argument would be to just fix it at home first? You know, is it nature or nurture, you know?
And I don't think anybody, if we weren't a world of sound bites where everybody's trying to get their tweet to be noticed or trying to get their 15 seconds on TV, I think we would all sit back and admit that this is an issue that does need to be fixed at home before it needs to be fixed in the school, because there is no fix. You could arm every single person at a school and it still doesn't fix the fact that somebody wanted to come in and do this. And I think that that's something that we forget, that for every person that does this, there are others that want to and don't. And that is partially a success, but also partially what's going on that's causing people to want to do this, to engage in such a horrific, earth-shattering event. And I don't think we can dismiss the fact that this is a home issue. You know, as I was thinking about this for the last couple of days, I was looking at what are some commonalities in these individuals that we keep seeing. And the one thing that keeps popping up is the fact that the ones that I can think of in the past, you know, 15 years, everything from Columbine to Sandy Hook to this most recent one, they're people that were kind of dismissed from the herd. They were people who didn't have their own, they may have had their own small clique, but that clique was also maybe dismissed from the herd. I think that was the Columbine shooters. You know, they were part of a niche that kind of got separated from the rest of the school. The Lanzhou boy from Sandy Hook was definitely ostracized. This young man had been expelled from school, had lost both his parents. Again, out of the herd. And we tend, when we have our own herds, when we have our own groups, when we have our own tribes, we tend to kind of fall in and protect our tribes. And these people don't seem to have a tribe to kind of fall into. And so when we say, how did we miss this person? A lot of these people were loners, and there was really nobody to really catch them. And that's not an excuse. It's just an observation. It's not an excuse, but it's a reason as to why maybe we're not seeing it in these people, because they're not within a herd that is looking to protect the rest of the herd.
So it sounds like the more we are disconnected from each other through social media, it's almost resulting in, you know, higher cases of that. I mean, there are people, I remember when I was in school, the people that you would consider out of the herd and the people that you graduate with that you didn't know were in your, you know, your grade. And to even try to fathom to put myself in one of those people's shoes, I mean, it's impossible. Like, just to think of how lonely you must feel, you know, and to get my mind inside like one of those killers, they're just so broken, you know, they're so broken. It's almost sad that we let it get to that point. You know, it's almost like, that should have been caught sooner. It really, really should have been something should have been done sooner about that. And I don't think there's any other way around it. I do think that there are guns that people definitely need to have more restrictions on, and at least background checked more thoroughly beforehand, and training too. I mean, that's another thing. But there's such a huge amount of unempathetic, selfish people that are being raised just to take selfies. That's the one thing they learn in school, is how to, you know, take the best selfie. I mean, where do you think this is all going? Where do you think there's hope for this country? Do you think that there's a way we can turn this around?
Well,
this generation I'm talking about in specific, the generation who's growing up, you know, who are lost in social media, I guess.
You know, I have hope, because I think every generation looks at the next one and says, you're the ones that's going to drive us off the cliff. And as I get closer and closer to sitting on my porch in my rocking chair and shaking my fist at the kids walking by, and every day I feel like I'm getting closer to that. I have to take a step back and say, well, you know, I was there at one point, and I must have been just as annoying to the generation before me. You know, every generation does their level of stupid things. It seems like the generation today seems to be doing it on a more catastrophic level, almost having to up the ante. And I hate minimizing it and getting it down to trying to blame social media or anything in particular. But I do think that the way people get attention nowadays is to be more bombastic, is to be more, you know, to be the person that does something even more bizarre. There are people who are trying to get attention from eating Tide Pods, and so they're okay with harming themselves, and so harming other people is just an extension of that. You know, to say, you know, is the world doomed? No, the world's not doomed, but we have to figure out how to drive people in the right direction. My personal belief is gun control, you know, is not the fundamental answer. And that's not because I'm pro-gun or anti-gun. It's because I'm pro-realism. You take away all the guns, and if somebody wants to do harm, but, you know, you look at Europe, one of the big things that is happening right now are people using trucks and cars to just plow people over. You take away cars and trucks, then, you know, you go back to, what is it, the 80s, when they had the tainted bear aspirin. Somebody could just go into a school and put some nasty things into the cafeteria food, and you could have a catastrophe just as bad as a shooting. If somebody wants to do harm, they're going to do harm. there are, we can't, what are we going to do? We're going to take all the rocks away and replace it with Nerf. It's not possible. In countries that don't have guns, we see things that are actually, you know, seem to us to be more horrific, like acid attacks. We don't have, fortunately, you know, knock on wood, we don't have a lot of acid attacks, but if you go over to Europe and the Middle East, there are people who are throwing acid in the face of people that they don't like. I'm definitely not trying to minimize a shooting spree, but that's pretty horrific as well. And it's, you can't take away acid from the world. It's, there's just, if people want to do harm, they're going to do harm. Yeah, and so we have to figure out.
You replaced, you know, with something else if you take it away.
Yep. Pick your poison. You know, if we take away, you know, if you take a drug off of the market, it's always replaced by another drug. If you take gambling off the market, there's another form of gambling. If you take, you know, if you take legal alcohol off the market, you know, you get bootleg. Humans are adaptable in the best ways and in the worst ways.
So it's the fact that you can get everything so easily with that. Is that a fact of it? Like a person with depression who has a gun is way more likely to commit suicide than a person with depression without a gun, you know? So in that sense, what do you do about someone when you talk about mental illness, a person with a gun, you know?
Well, if somebody is, it has, truly does have suicidal ideations, the availability of an end of life tool is not going to either make them do it or preclude them from doing it. They're going to access it. I do agree that it may be more immediate. I haven't read any research about, whether or not, you know, having, if there's a high, I guarantee you it stands to reason that people with guns available are more susceptible to suicide by gun, because that just makes sense. You know, if you have a car, you're more susceptible to driving and wrecking. But I do, you know, there's just because some people will do that, other people argue that that shouldn't preclude responsible gun ownership. And I don't even want to get into the poli sci aspect of, you know, Second Amendment and people arming themselves and militias and all kinds of fun things. There's arguments on both sides. Yes, there are civilizations in the world today where there are no guns and everything is peachy. There are civilizations right now today that there are no guns, but there are. And when you make guns illegal, only criminals will have the guns. And I don't know if that's the right answer or not.
So if you were president, what would be your option? What would you try to do? What measure would you take to try to tackle this problem?
First thing I would do is retire and figure out who made me president, because that was a bad idea. But if I have to make some kind of decision, I don't know, because any decision that is made right now is so politicized. It's that right now, I think the figure I heard is that there's like 380, 400 million guns in the United States and only 350 million people. There's more guns than people. We could go the route of Australia where we offer to buy them back, but they only got a third of the guns out of people's hands. And so the only people who sold them back were people that probably weren't going to use them anyway. And this is an assumption, but the criminal is not going to sell back their gun because they need it for their way of life. The hunter is not going to sell theirs back because they need it for their way of life. The family member who lives in a bad neighborhood is not going to sell theirs back because it's part of their way of life. So confiscation, that doesn't even make any sense whatsoever. You know, the idea of some form of check feels good on the surface, but I look at research, and this is maybe a bad analogy. I don't know, but I'm famous for bad analogies. We look at people who have narcolepsy. Narcolepsy is where you fall asleep, you go directly into REM sleep. And it's one of the disorders where if a doctor finds that you have narcolepsy, they're supposed to immediately revoke your driver's license. Well, it's well known that there, you know, over the road truck drivers, if you go to the doctor and you find out you have narcolepsy, the doctor is going to take away your driver's license. So what do? They just treat themselves. They don't go in and get treated for narcolepsy because they can't lose their driver's license. The analogy would be, if I know that I have mental illness, but I want to possess a gun, well, then I'm just not going to go in and get treated, because the only way to know that somebody has mental illness is to go in and get diagnosed by somebody. So if you want to do psychological testing for every gun purchase, on a professional level, I support it, because that means more psychologists have more jobs. But I also know that there's going to be a website that's going to be up within days, probably on Reddit, on how to answer the questions correctly so that you can get your gun, even if you're batshit crazy. So that isn't the answer. Waiting periods don't seem to be the answer, because in the last few situations, they've been stockpiled. So it's not like somebody did this off the cuff. If you're pressuring me to say that, you know, what is the one thing I would do? I don't know. I guess the easiest way is to say, let's look at curtailing these rapid fire. And I hate to the AR-15s, but again, you know, most people don't need those, but you're making that the devil, and it's not the devil. It's just a nasty looking gun that does rapid fire, does hold a bigger clip, but
I mean, aren't there certain types of shotguns that are illegal, and like, you can't possess, I mean, explosives for a reason, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't own a nuclear bomb. I can't own a grenade launcher. I can't own, again, every state is going to be different, but I think that there's some really, really heavy duty licensure that is required to own a fully automatic gun. But to be perfectly honest, a fully automatic gun in these situations would almost be counterintuitive, because you would be, it would be hard to control, you know. Mm-hmm. If you look at the people that have committed these crimes in the last, you know, if you look at like the major faces that I can see, which would be the Sandy Hook shooters, the Columbine shooters, the Florida shooter, they weren't big military dudes. They were littler guys. And if you tried to give them a fully automatic gun, it would almost, in my mind, I just see cartoonishly them falling over, because the recoil would just push them back. I even think like a bump stock would probably, it wouldn't work for them. These guns that they use are powerful, but they're not powerful enough that it would stop them. So again, as I'm sitting here, again, this is not my level of expertise, and anybody who knows more about guns is probably screaming right now at how ignorant I sound. But to me, it doesn't seem like the weapon is the problem. It's the person. But knowing how hard it is to just get somebody admitted for a 72-hour hold, I don't know how we can curtail them from owning something that they can access in many different ways.
Hmm. What about the argument that it's all of our problems, or the people who, I wouldn't say all of our problems, but on a level, the fact that we let people slip by those cracks and I guess just live so sad and lost and not in a group, not accepted by anyone. I feel like that's almost irresponsible on someone who claims they, you know, have empathy or have a heart and cares about other people. I mean, shouldn't we be reaching out to everyone? And if not, shouldn't you tell on your neighbor who seems dangerous? And I know in this case scenario, it did happen, and the FBI had some heat over that, because they were looking into this kid a couple of times like a couple of months ago before the situation, and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm. It's a fine line. It really is, because, you know, some people are you know, okay, so using my verbiage, some people are extremely introverted, but they're not dangerous at all. I would venture to say that some of the people that live in my neighborhood, that I've never spoken to, could, you know, if we're using that logic, could look at me and say, wow, that person, I see him leave, I see him come, I see him mow his lawn, but other than that, he doesn't talk to me. Maybe we should call the FBI and make sure that he's a safe dude. You know, and I guess I wouldn't have a problem if the FBI showed up and asked if I'm a safe dude, but we have to be careful with that because we are getting fragmented from our communities. You know, look back and 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you couldn't, it would be impossible to live isolated unless you were just a woodsman. You know, as we've kind of made it easy, I was just talking in class today about the fact that with agoraphobia, it's possible now to really be agoraphobic and nobody know it, because, you know, with Amazon and Papa John's delivering, and you know, you wouldn't have to leave your bedroom. I mean, you literally could now that, you know, I think Amazon or somebody starting to do pharmacy delivery. I mean, geez, you could really be okay for, you know, never leaving your house. And those aren't the dangerous people, but we may not know what's going on inside those houses until catastrophe. Right.
There would be an enormous amount of calls that the FBI would get for people who, you know, are just recluses.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think there's any way of preventing it? Do you think that we should teach empathy to younger children? Do you think that we should start teaching emotional, like just being emotionally intelligent and how to control your emotions and how to deal with them and how to deal with others? You know, I feel like that is something that's very, very undertaught in our schools. And I remember, I mean, even just when I started going to school, I feel like they, like in elementary school, bullying, tackling the bullying situation just started becoming like a thing. And I just, they need to go harder on that because I feel like that's a main cause. That's a main cause of it. Oh, I can't hear you here. There it is.
Okay. It's too late. Okay. So yeah, I think that there is something to that. There's been research to show that emotional intelligence is something that needs to kind of be taught and kind of be focused on. There is a less vocal group of social scientists who kind of argue the counter, that as we try and artificially manipulate the social interactions of people, that we're creating these situations where people no longer know how to cope when their coping mechanisms are no longer working for them. And so if we continually tell people, don't bully, don't bully, don't bully, don't bully, and then they get into a situation where there is a bully situation, they have no clue how to cope with it. And it's basically the nerfification of the world. It's, you know, if you never let your child interact with people, and you vaccinate them with everything you can, and you sanitize the house every, you know, twice a day, the first time they go out into the world and see it, you know, get a germ on them, they're going to get very sick. There's a growing concern about if we keep telling people that we punish the bully, and we don't allow people to have a normal interaction as they grow up. They tend to, when they do run into something, they don't know how to cope with it. Now, am I saying to let's get rid of anti-bullying programs? No, because we need to teach on both sides. You know, bullying is not an effective way to express your own frustration, your own anger. Getting bullied is not a good thing for anybody. But we're trying to create such an artificial world for people that a lot of times I think that we're not preparing people to deal with problems once they get out in the world. We have helicopter parents who don't allow kids to fail. We have, again, I'm getting my cane out and I'm going to start wagging it. You know, everybody gets a ribbon. We're not going to keep score. And we're not allowing kids to understand that these negative emotions are part of life, that they need to be able to cope with negative emotions. And it's not, let's blow up when they show up. I need to get back at people, but you know, I need to be able to deal with these emotions, and these emotions are on me to be able to deal with.
So you're saying if you teach someone, theoretically, if you continue to try to teach a kid to push away things that make him angry, or just to avoid anger in general, then in a situation will arise where something will make him inevitably angry and he won't know how to handle that at all.
A little bit. Yeah. I think that when we try to keep kids out of situations where we believe that they will be exposed to that anger. So I'm a proponent of learning trials, you know, allow the situation to play out a little bit before you step in and stop it. So, you know, you don't let the bully beat down the other child, but you allow it to play out to a point where both individuals don't expect that somebody's going to step in every time and fix the problem, because then the bully starts to realize, you know, somebody's going to stop me from doing this. And the victim is going to believe, well, somebody's going to stop in and step in and save me. Well, I mean, is it possible that the shooter in Florida thought, well, somebody's going to step in and stop me from bullying? Because I think it looks as though he was bullied a lot in his life. So maybe he expected that somebody was going to step in and stop him, and he could teach the other people a lesson. This is completely theoretical. Less than 1% that this is actually what was going on in his head, but it's a possibility.
So you can, I lost my train of thought here. Shit.
That's what the editing button's for.
Yeah. I lost it. I cannot think of it right now.
It'll come to you in about an hour.
Yeah, I know, right? I should have wrote it down. So it really seems like we have to teach kids by trial and error, and almost be there for, like, it's all about teaching when they fail, you know, like the greatest failure or the greatest teacher is failure. And you can only learn from, I guess, your mistakes, you know, like empowering a kid to stick up for himself is more important than sticking up for the kid yourself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And allowing kids to feel some pain and feel some negative emotions. You know, kids, adults are better, and we forget. We are better at understanding things theoretically and applying them. Kids aren't that way. You know, if I tell my daughter that eating a whole pint of ice cream is going to make her belly hurt, she can't really conceptualize that. So unfortunately, one or two times in her life, I'm going to have to let her eat that whole pint of ice cream, and her belly's going to hurt, so that she can look back to that and say, wow, that was not a good idea. And I can remember growing up, my parents did the same thing. You know, growing up on a farm, you know, they can tell you all day, don't touch the electric fence. But the first time that I tried to step over and make it, I remembered from that day on, electric fence hurts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people, you know, don't mess on my parents. They were fine. Now it's called, but, kids have to learn, and kids have experiences. Bad experiences from my daughter. I wish she could live a Princess Disney life, but I also know that I would be setting her up as an adult. So, yeah.
So how do we, it's not like we can just go and tell every parent that they have to, you know, train or teach their kids in this manner. It's almost like we don't have a choice but to start it in the school system. We don't have a choice because that's the only time you really get someone else's kid and have the opportunity to fill their head with other knowledge, you know? And that would be the most crucial time to implement a program where, I don't know. I feel like there's something, it hasn't been created yet, but I feel like we haven't, as a nation, put effort to thinking about something that we can put in place that can maybe in the future, you know, prevent some of these things and just in general create a more emotionally stable people.
And you're not alone. Yeah. That's what everybody's thinking right now. And to be perfectly honest, if you had if in this podcast you said the thing that created the idea that started, we would be sitting on a Nobel Prize from your podcast. We're all in the same boat that we need to figure something out, but it's everybody comes to the table with a different appetite, and everybody has a different background. And even if you teach something in school, it can be negated at home. You teach something at home, it can be negated at school. It's just like psychiatry. We want the magic pill that makes everybody feel good. And it's not there. I don't want to say it's a good thing that these horrific things happen. It's not. But it's also a little naive of us to think that we're going to be able to prevent everything from happening. So we have to find a happy middle ground, and there is no happy middle ground because we don't want bad things to happen.
Yeah.
And we're not going to tell people to stop thinking about it. And, you know, just don't think about the bad things because you need to consider it. But if we could figure it out today, we wouldn't need to think about it anymore. And I think it's been we're not the first generation nor the last that need to consider what to do with this. And it's going to be an ongoing struggle.
Yeah. If I was in that situation where someone around me or someone I went to school with for a couple of years did something of that level, especially someone I never maybe would have expected. I'm not saying he wasn't one of those people, because I know that people were saying he was, people thought that he was one of the type of kids to do that. But in other situations, I would have a problem trusting anybody again, and just I would constantly fear everyone's behavior, everyone's intent. That would really I feel like mess me up. I can't even imagine. Where do you begin to like recover after that? Like, would you even? How would those kids, students going to school? How are they going to finish the year if some students refuse or parents refuse to send their kids there? Like, is there going to be a mass amount of kids who are held back a year because of that incident? Like, I don't know.
And we can only look at history. You know, I can't remember. I think Columbine. I know that they never went back to that school, but I think that they started classes up at a different school. I think the same thing happened at Sandy Hook. To be honest, each student is going to have to take their own journey. Some are going to be ready to be back in school now. Some are going to struggle. Some that really had no direct impact of that day are still going to have a harder time going of it because they lived it vicariously. And I don't think we should discount that. It's definitely going to, it's the same thing as, you know, when you are living your life and all of a sudden there's a major illness that comes down in yourself or a close family member, you have the next 5 years of your life kind of mapped out. And then all of a sudden, boom, you're hit with something and it changes everything. And I think that's the same thing we're looking at here. Those students and those families are going to have to kind of take a step back and say, you know, graduating in 2019 with my class was the original goal. And as of last week, that has changed for me. And they have to kind of change their direction and understand that this was one of those turning point events for them. And again, the word fair is going to be bantered around that it's not fair. It's right. It's not fair, but it's what is going to happen for these young people. And it's sad.
Yeah. So that's so terrible to think that this just continues to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just continuing to argue about, you know, if it's a gun or person problem. And like we've been talking about, it's both, but it's so much more. It's so much more. There's so much to even begin to cauterize this wound that we have. I mean, as we are digging deeper, you know, I don't know where to begin. I can't even see a spot. You have to almost do all these things at once,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just hope that it starts improving, because nothing is going to get better instantly at all. We really do just have to wait and keep our eyes, you know, open and vigilant and hope for the best. But I feel like just sitting around talking about it and arguing about it between all this Facebook stuff is just not productive.
No, it's not, but it's what people can do. Unfortunately, this is one of those things where people feel like they want to do something, they need to do something, they need to advocate for something. And that's all, you know, sitting 1500 miles away, what more can you do? You know, there's only so many hugs and so many, you know, nice thoughts that you can send to these victims before you realize there's not much else that you can do to accomplish something. And so we want to feel like we're doing something. And unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do, but there are things we can do. We can just be vigilant and we can be mindful. The things that we might say were missed down there. So if we, you know, instead of talking about, you know, what they missed, maybe having a conversation with that young man or young woman or adult person who seems to be a little bit distant. Your job is not to diagnose them. Your job is not to ask them if they're going to shoot up a school. Your job is just to have a conversation with them. And maybe that conversation stops them from thinking about doing something bizarre. Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't think I'm encouraging anybody to do anything that's going to harm anybody. Being nice. These things sound so silly, but I'm putting on my Carl Rogers or Fred Rogers hat. You know, smiling at somebody, telling somebody hi has never killed anybody, as far as I know. So it's something positive we can do.
Yeah, that's the thing that really, like what we were saying about teaching kids, you know, emotional stabilization and stuff like that could have its side effects. But one of the things that we really do need to teach and almost ingrain into everybody is to treat people how you want to be treated, and to
absolutely, yeah,
completely understand how your actions impact others. Everything that you do, every piece of litter that you throw on the ground will have a longer impact. And I feel like the butterfly effect is something that should be almost a full-on course that you need to study throughout your, like, you know, growing years. And you mm-hmm. should almost know, like, the butterfly effect, like the back of your hand, and the fact that, you know, everything, whether it is from raising a child, everything you do influencing and raising a child to watching that child as a friend from a friend's point of view, you know, watching him in school. I mean, there's so many things that you can do by just what you said, smiling and being a good person, that literally can go such a long way if we all just got on the same team.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's small things. It's not passing new laws. No matter which side of the fence you're on with that, you know, passing laws is a bigger, and it has less effect on your day to day than anything you could possibly do. So just do everybody, if everybody does their thing, you know, I love that the phrase, you know, before you start telling other people what they're doing wrong, first make your bed, you know, make sure that you've got your stuff together. You know, do what you need to do. And if everybody focused on themselves, then we wouldn't have to focus on other people. And that's what laws are. Laws are basically everybody saying collectively, somebody else is going to do something wrong and we have to stop them from doing it. Well, if everybody just took responsibility for themselves, wouldn't have to deal with laws. But again, that's Smurf Village Utopia.
This is an interesting talk with you, though. I'm glad that we were able to have this while it was relevant, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully it's something that historically we can look back and say that was relevant. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be relevant again and again. And getting back to that pessimistic, optimistic, that's a pessimistic way of looking at it. But I think it's realistic that this is a problem that's not going to be solved today, but maybe we can take small steps.
Yeah, I've heard from someone that in order to draw these lines, whether it's gun control or whatever type of laws that we have now, there has to be versions. Sometimes extreme versions need to happen in order for these lines to be drawn in the sand. And maybe that's kind of, we can't see it now because we're in the moment of it, but maybe that's kind of what we're experiencing, the most extreme of it happening. And then this is going to result in something afterwards that, you know, can lead us in the right direction. Maybe we kind of, as fucked up and bad as it is to say, maybe this was the necessary evil that we need to wake up as a country and to, you know, turn our hearts on.
Yeah. Here's to that, you know, because I don't want to have another even more horrific event happen to get our attention. If this didn't get our attention, then I don't know what will.
Yes, I agree on that. Well, thanks for coming on here. I appreciate that.
No problem. I appreciate it.
We'll have to do it again.
Okay.
Thanks for listening, everybody.